Paleo nerds.
Two grown men.
One plays with dolls.
The other draws dinosaurs with crayons.
Together, they explore the prehistoric past with experts from across the globe.
Paleo nerds.
Because deep time will blow your mind.
Welcome to Paleo Nerds, the podcast. I'm David Strassman, professional ventriloquist, amateur paleontologist.
Fossils?
And we're going to be talking to Alaskan artist Ray Troll.
That's me.
A fellow paleo nerd. And where are you?
I am sitting in my living room here in Ketchikan, Alaska, looking out over the Tongass Narrows. It's a rainy day.
What is a Tongass Narrows?
Well, I live in the Tongass National Forest. It's a native name. Tongass means the head of a sea lion.
And, oh, I never knew that.
That's right. Yeah, no, I'm one of the few people that actually knows that. And because I asked a member of the Tongass tribe, what does Tongass mean? It means the head of a sea lion.
So what is a narrows?
Well, the narrows is a little narrow passage of water. I'm looking out at Panic Island across the way. And that's the Tongass Narrows, and ships come and go, and I can see them coming and going.
And now, because of the COVID-19, there are no cruise ships for the entire year.
There's nary a boat in the channel. Where are you, Dave?
I am in Ojai, California. And Ojai is a beautiful little rural town surrounded by mountains, an hour and a half north of Los Angeles. And Ojai means the nest. It's a Chumash Native American Indian word. Ojai is protected from weather. It's protected from fires, as we saw a couple of years ago. Every square inch of forest burned around Ojai, but the town itself. So,
wow.
We are fortunate to be in the nest.
I'm an artist. I make my living doing art. I've been drawing pictures all my life. What do you do, Dave?
I play with dolls for a living.
Wow. We're two lucky guys. How is it that a person plays with dolls for a living?
Well, I'm a ventriloquist, and I perform all over the world, mostly now, though, in Australia and New Zealand, England, Ireland, Scotland. How does someone get started, you want to know?
Well, I want to know. I mean, how is it that you perform over there, and we don't know about you here in the United States? What's up with that?
Oh, I had a huge career in the United States in the late 80s and very early 90s. I was on all the TV shows.
Introduce a ventriloquist like this. Ladies and gentlemen, a man and a piece of wood. I hope they make you laugh. Mr. David Strassman.
And then I got an invite to Australia.
G'day, mate.
And I went ballistic there, and I basically found immense fame and came home. No one knew who I was, and I loved that fact that I could walk into a grocery store in my own hometown and not get hounded by fans and autograph seekers. So I was able to establish notoriety in one part of the world and complete anonymity in the other. That's the way it's been ever since, and I love it.
And we met all those years ago, and I doubted that story for many years until I actually went to Australia, and until I interviewed just about every Australian I ever ran into. Do you know who David Strassman is? And by golly, I'd say 90% of them knew you.
Does the name David Strassman mean anything to you?
Not to me.
Not to me either.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I am. I'm a ventriloquist, and you're an artist, but we are here on a podcast called Paleo Nerds. What is a paleo nerd, Ray?
What is a paleo nerd? A paleo nerd is a grown man or woman who still loves dinosaurs as much as they did when they were a kid, if not more so.
That childlike wonder of dinosaurs and those little plastic little guys in the sand.
That's how it started for me, man. I got some toys mom and dad bought me for Christmas, I think in 1959, maybe 1960.
God, I was 3 years old then.
Yeah, I know. I'm much older than you, Dave. But that's where my dinosaur love started. And, you know, I mean, most kids go through a phase like that, but You know, and then about age 9 or 10, they give it up. But others, like the true paleo nerds, keep it going their entire
lives. Did you have like a plastic set of dinosaurs, a little plastic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And actually, my brother found the very set. So I've actually got the set all over again. And I was kind of weeping when I saw the little Allosaurus and the Tyrannosaurus. And yeah, it was pretty cool.
You have the actual little dinosaurs that piqued your interest.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Well, my father took me to the La Brea Tar Pits when I was a child because we lived not far from there. And at the time, there was no museum. There was just a bunch of seeping tar holes with fences around them and one pit that was being excavated, which you couldn't look into.
So there was no museum there at the time?
No museum. This is before the George C. Page Museum. And two things happened. Once, I fell in love with elephants and mammoths, just fell in love with the idea of that they were alive not too long ago, and there's the bones right there. And I saw a sparrow in the tar.
Half, oh, really?
Half in the tar. It was dead.
Ah!
Yeah. It was dead, but I realized, oh, no, that bird is going to sink in the tar pits.
You went to see the seeping tar holes. I like the sound of that. It's kind of weird.
Sounds dirty.
Yeah, it sounds dirty, but so you saw the seeping tar, actually not tar pits, I think they call them tar seeps, I think, officially, but there was no museum at the time. But how old were you when Dad took you there?
Oh, I would have been five or six, so we're talking 62.
Boomer.
There was actually a tusk sticking out of the tar?
No, there is this rotunda that was a pit that was excavated. It's a round rotunda. It's still there. The gates are locked. You can't go in. You can kind of see in. And down about 15 feet from where there's a round circular observation deck, you look down and there was a pile of jumbled bones like you see, you know.
Right.
La Brea's bones, nothing came out as a complete skeleton, as you know. It literally is a jumble of bones. Because you think there were no complete skeletons there. In fact, most of the skeletons at the George C. Page Museum are comprised of many individuals because they could never just find a complete skeleton.
Yeah, lots of times that is the case. Almost anywhere in the world, you rarely find articulated skeletons. But every now and then, it happens. My paleo passion started with that dinosaur set. But what I started doing, you know, age four, I distinctly remember picking up that crayon and drawing. The very first thing I can remember drawing ever in my life, dinosaurs. I think I drew a triceratops. And, of course, doing the sound effects, I had to have the Tyrannosaurus coming at it. And I've been drawing ever since, man.
But what was your inspiration? Was it Harryhausen's stop action or was it the books? And the plastic models?
It was the book and plastic models. And also at the time, there actually was sort of a little paleo scene there in the early 60s. And you could get dinosaurs would come in, you get little toys in your cereal boxes. So along with the sugar. So I began to associate dinosaurs with food and sugar and all that. But I would demand, I have
Pavlov's Triceratops.
I have many siblings and I would fight them. I would insist, Rainey gets the dinosaur. So I'd fight them, get the dinosaurs and all that. But soon I began to, find that drawing was something I was good at. And I began to parlay my dinosaur drawings for favors at the school and at kindergarten. So
really,
that was kind of, that was the start of, favors.
If you show me yours, I'll show you mine.
You know, I want to play in that swing set now. Dinosaur drawing. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
No way. What was the first drawing you ever did that you got like really serious recognition?
The kindergarten teacher had me do the school set for the play. So I got to paint the giant shoe. The kids, the mother and the old lady lived in the shoe. But I began to immediately go, wait a minute, I'm onto something. I'm being treated special because I can draw. And it was the dinosaurs that led me there. And really, it's so deeply ingrained in me, Dave, that but the first word I can remember spelling was dinosaur.
Serious.
I wanted to be an artist my entire life, but there was a moment there around the Apollo moon landings and all that same period, way back in 1969, 68, where I wanted to be a pilot and
really?
Join the Air Force. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that one.
I love airplanes almost as much as I love dinosaurs.
No way. So, I love airplanes as much as
I know.
Love dinosaurs.
Let's switch the podcast topic. No. Because I've got airplane books over there.
Well, I was a private pilot for 30 years.
Clear for takeoff.
And along with being a ventriloquist.
Along with being a ventriloquist.
I'm not moving my lips right now.
Let's get back on topic.
What does paleo mean?
Paleo means
old.
What does it mean? Paleo. Old. Thank you. Old.
It's old. Yeah. It's what you are, Ray, because you keep saying you're older than me.
I am. I am, David. You're not truly a paleo nerd, then. You didn't dive way deep into it as a kid. I mean, you did kind of.
Not at all.
And NASA and the astronauts, that was your main thing. When did you rekindle this interest? How did you come back around to it? So mine has been steady on all throughout my life, and yours has started and stopped, it sounds like.
My brother, who passed away in 2007, he had a love of geology, and he told me about John McPhee's book, Basin and Range. And I read John McPhee's introductory book on geology and then got hooked, and that led me to the rediscover of paleontology. And I was living in New York at the time. When I moved to California, I realized I now have access to the deserts and amazing fossil sites. And that was really what rekindled my interest in paleontology. And I started reading voraciously in the 80s and 90s. I read Wonderful Life by Stephen Gould. I read The Dinosaur Heresies by
Bakker,
yeah. He's the, of course, the fictional character, or the non-fictional character depicted in Jurassic Park.
He gets eaten.
Yeah, so it was voracious reading of anything I could get my hands on. And then I started collecting.
And then one day you and I met.
I moved to Ketchikan, bought a house in Ketchikan in 2001.
And you had been doing shows up in the Anchorage area, right? So you had been entertaining in Alaska.
I came to Alaska in 1980. I got a call that said, you're hired in a topless, bottomless strip club for $600 a week for 6 weeks. And it starts in 2 weeks. And I went, I am there.
Wow.
Oh, man.
That's another tale. So it was in that year, 2001, that we met. And I think the very first words out of your mouth were, I have the biggest megalodon tooth in the world, or one of.
Mine's bigger than yours.
You've been saying that for years, and actually I think that's on my shelf now.
I believe I passed that baton to you, and you now own it. And one day, you'll have to give it away to someone.
I don't want it anymore.
So Dave, hey, I want to know, man, what is the coolest fossil that you have ever found?
I haven't found that many cool ones, but I think the coolest paleo thing I ever found was not a fossil, it was an arrowhead. I've never found an arrowhead. And I was out in the Sonoran Desert near Bisbee, Arizona, closer to actually Tombstone, Arizona, in some Devonian marine sediment where you find crinoids and little bits of shell and stuff like that.
Crinoids, Dave.
Crinoids, sorry.
Crinoids, also known as sea lilies, are still alive today with over 600 species living in the oceans. They are a class within the Echinodermata phylum. The echinoderms also include sea stars, brittle stars, sea urchins, sand dollars, and sea cucumbers. And yes, you can eat a sea cucumber even though they're slimy and really weird looking. And sea urchins too, for that matter, but watch out for those spines.
Crinoids. If it wasn't for you, I'd be mispronouncing the entire taxonomic dictionary.
He's always correcting me.
And I'm out there looking for crinoid parts, which they're quite abundant near this road cut, and it's hot, and I look down out in the middle of the desert, and there is an arrowhead just sitting out there. And I literally just went, oh my God, how long has this been here? Why is this here? It's not obviously near a cave or a village site. This is probably an arrow that some Native American shot at an animal and missed, and he lost his arrow, and the shaft long has dissolved away. And to me, that was one of the greatest finds ever. And of course, over the years, I've found trilobites, some of the oldest ones in the Mojave Desert, and found the only dinosaur tracks in California. I found all kinds of stuff, but I think that would have been my joy moment, finding that one arrowhead.
What land were you on at that time? Was it BLM land or was it public land?
I have no idea. I'm guessing. Are you going to call someone to have me arrested?
I'm just saying there's some collecting rules, isn't it? Yes, yeah. Yeah, there are.
In fact, you were telling me we should interview a guy, the whole dinosaur debacle, the T-Rex that was...
Oh, that gets very complicated very fast. Dinosaur named Sue, T-Rex?
That's right.
Yeah.
The dinosaur that got...
impounded by the FBI and drug out in court for many, many years. But Dinosaur 13, there's a movie about it.
Dinosaur 13. So tell me, that was my amazing find that really blew me away. And of course, I was standing next to my ex-wife when she found a pumice.
I think you say pumice, actually.
Are you just going to correct me on everything? Pumice, pumice?
But then we can also go to the dictionary.
You know what? I'll grimace as you say pumice.
Yeah, Google it. All right. You were about to ask me for a cool story?
Well, what is the most amazing drop-to-your-knees fossil find in your lifetime?
Well, I lived a fossil-deprived childhood. You know, I was drawing dinosaurs. I was obsessed with dinosaurs. And I was an Air Force brat, so we were moving all the time. I was actually in some pretty good fossil territory, but I was never able to really go find fossils. I found a few brachiopods as a kid.
All right, Ray.
What's a brachiopod?
Brachiopod, it looks like a clamshell, but Devonian clamshells up in western New York, around the town of Corning, where I was born. And that was pretty cool, but nothing truly memorable. And so I was living this fossil-deprived life, but I would also pick up the random rock every now and then and go, wow, this is a leg bone of a T-Rex. It must be. And I would collect these things, and then, of course, I'd show them to an adult that might know something. And my heart was always broken. No, it's just a rock, right? But as a middle-aged man, I finally learned that you got to go to where the fossils are. You're not going to find them just any old place. There are certain type of rocks you need to go to. And if you go to those rocks...
Having said that, I do remember being in a car on the way to Red Rocks in Colorado with Kirk Johnson.
Kirk Johnson, by the way, is currently head of the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C.
And we pulled off the road and went to some neighborhood in Denver. And he said, oh, do you want to see a stegosaurus bones sticking out of the side of the hill?
It was a triceratops, actually.
Stegosaurus, triceratops, okay.
It was a triceratops. The bone is still in the guy's backyard. And there it was. And actually, yeah, Kirk and I, he took me there. We looked at it. And there are more bones. But he has no idea that he's got that stuff in his backyard.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a triceratops and maybe a duckbill dinosaur. Not a stegosaurus. Those were Jurassic. So we were in Cretaceous.
You're right. Stegosaurus were not even in Jurassic. The same period as T-Rexes.
Colorado's got Jurassic and Cretaceous stuff. But anyways... probably my ultimate moment of dinosaur or just fossil hunting was being lucky enough to go on a trip to the Colville River. Cretaceous outcrops along the Colville River on the very northern edge of Alaska in 2012. And I was with four other guys.
Is this North Slope?
Yeah, North Slope. And Cretaceous bone beds up there. And talk about lots of bones. And when you go to a bone bed locality, it's only a matter of moments before you see lots and lots of bones.
But they're chunks, though. They're not museum quality. They're just so many of them, but they're chunks, right?
There's a lot of chunks. The world is full of chunkosauruses. But when you go to a bone bed, there's beautiful bones. And there were hadrosaur, and these were hadrosaur bones.
Duckbill dinosaur, right.
But the challenge to find in the midst of all of these hundreds of duckbill dinosaur bones was to find the evidence of a predatory dinosaur. And at the end of a week, almost a week out there on the Colville River, there on the muddy slopes of the Colville, Dr. Johnson is in the hole next to me. He's digging away. Hadrosaur bone. Finally, I'm just trying to remember this, which came first. But
the chicken?
Well, he was finding all these tailbone, baby hadrosaur tailbone section, laying all out one after the other. And I'm finding
from the same individual, or were these just a collection?
They look like at least one complete tail from one individual, so slightly articulated. One after the other. He had maybe 60 of these all lined up. I'm not kidding. They're just all, what? There's another one, a very neat little hole. And I'm digging away, and it's raining. But then, clink, there I found it. I found the Nanuksaurus tooth, and that's a tyrannosaur. It's before Tyrannosaurus rex evolved. This was about 70 million years old. And There was...
Wait, 70 million from present day?
From present day, yeah.
So you're saying million, 5 million before the end of the Cretaceous?
Yeah.
And there were Tyrannosauruses 5 million 4 years million. Before the... Tyrannosauruses evolved from their predecessor 4 million before they all got wiped out?
Most species in the world, when you talk to folks, how long do species last or whatever?
I didn't know that. Tyrannosaurus, I mean, obviously there's so many theropod giant meat eaters
right.
for 100 million years. But you're saying the Tyrannosaurus, like Sue in Chicago Field Museum, that species is only 4 million years old?
No. It's probably less than that. Probably a million and a half.
You're saying the entire species of Tyrannosaurus only existed on planet Earth for a million and a half years?
When you're talking Tyrannosaurus rex.
Right.
Rex is the species.
Right.
Right? Tyrannosaurus is the genus.
Here's a quick aside. Just in case you're wondering, T-Rex lived and thrived in Western North America on a landmass known as Laramidia from 68 to 66 million years ago. That's 2 million years for the Tyra King's bloody reign. Most experts believe that it evolved from Despletosaurus, a relative of Albertosaurus, although some scientists favor the Asian Tyrannosaur, Tarbosaurus, as an ancestral contender. They all had big, toothy heads, huge legs, and tiny, tiny little arms.
This is what you begin to realize, too, with paleontology, is that everything is a verb, man. You know, life was so transient and malleable. Species come and go.
Right. So give me an example of a contemporary animal that's only a few hundred years old. I mean, some of the finches that have evolved in the Galapagos since Darwin. So I know there have been evidence of Darwinian evolution in the Galapagos finches since he was there. To say, oh, wow, look, some of these finches have adapted, they've changed, and we call them a new family or new genus?
Species.
New species.
My mnemonic for this, my slightly inappropriate mnemonic, is King
Phenomena.
King Philip can only fake good sex.
King, so kingdom.
King Philip, kingdom, phylum.
Phylum.
Class.
Class.
Can order.
Keep going.
Only fake family, good genus, sex. King Philip can only fake good sex.
I've got to memorize this?
This is okay. What happens when a ventriloquist and an artist try to do a podcast and explain science to people, man.
Yeah, but you're just explaining it to me because I don't know this stuff.
To be able to find a fossil of a living animal.
You mean an animal that once was living? What do you mean?
Right, but to find something in stone, the fossilization process, you know,
is... takes several million years.
Well, a fossil is evidence of any previous life, right?
Yes.
There can be bones from the Cretaceous that are still bone. But there can also be fence posts from the 1800s that have turned to rock. You know, I mean?
Correct.
So it's a big deal. When I was down in Washington State a few years back, we were working on the Cruising the Fossil Coastline book, went fossil fishing with David Montgomery from the University of Washington and Kirk Johnson. We went down to a fossil site in Washington State, and there were beautifully preserved 1-million-year-old sockeye salmon fossils. Our modern-day salmon, Oncorhynchus nerca, that's Oncorhynchus nerca.
Gesundheit.
And then there were the fossils that are a million years old, and it's the same species. It's the same genus and species. You don't get that because, really, species evolve and come and go. Our species alone, our species is maybe 200,000 years old. We're not a million years old as far as we know yet.
Correct.
But we keep pushing that back. But I'm just saying that it's all a blur. Like, where do you say a species starts and stops?
Of course, with the absence of fossils in the fossil record, there are gaps which are right. difficult to interpret. I have a question. If Tyrannosaurus rex is only a 4-million-year-old species...
1-million-year-old... Maybe.
1 million, maybe. Well, what was its... Well, that's because you've only found bones in that 1 million year of strata, correct?
You're correct. So you can get them in the formations, Hell Creek Formation.
But what was the species before Tyrannosaurus rex?
Oh, what is it? Albertosaurus is a candidate.
Right.
That's about at 68 million, I think.
And how long did he hang before he turned into T-Rex?
He or she. They were in that 68 million span. Nanuxaurus is maybe 69, 70 million years old. And then Hell Creek Formation is 66 million years old because this comet hits. And as some of my scientist buddies say, that you know, we're knowing so much more about calibrating time now. We might even get it down to the afternoon that the time of day that the comet hit.
Yeah, it was a Thursday at 3:30.
Let's get back to your Nanookosaurus, which reminds me of the Frank Zappa song, Please Don't Eat That Yellow Snow.
But watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow.
Let's go to your Nanookosaurus moment of wonder.
So there I was in that rainy little hole that day, that August day in 2012. Kirk beside me, he'd been finding all those dinosaur bones. And click, and there it was. I had my little hammer chipping away. And actually, I was surprised at how easy it was. This is actually not rock that we're going through. It's basically really tough, kind of hard dirt. So you could just sort of claw through the hard dirt and find click bone. And I clicked, and there it was. Picked up the tooth. It was about maybe 2 inches long, serrated edges. And if I get into the story enough, I actually start crying. I teared up. Because it was a childhood dream come true, and I'm tearing up now, man.
I think you're burping. You're burping, from the Coke you just drank. Don't bullshit me.
don't.
So wait, was this tooth have like the serrated edges on both sides?
Serrated edges on both sides. So it was a really cool moment because it was a childhood dream come true. I'd always dreamed of being a paleontologist. I was a 58-year-old man sitting in that muddy little hole at the time. And
crying over an old tooth.
That's pathetic.
Weeping. And Kirk took a picture of me. And then moments later, not to be outdone, what does the good doctor find? He finds something that maybe is arguably cooler. He found a raptor tooth. Which is very tiny, but talk about your razor edge on it. It was just serrated, but it was like a little tiny, ultra-sharp arrowhead. But
wow.
From a truodon, and some people say troodon.
What is it?
So I don't know.
Describe what a troodon looks like. Bipedal.
Troodon is a raptor. It's and actually, the Alaskan raptors were actually slightly larger than their southern cousins.
Okay, I need to just stop you right here. Alaskan dinosaur raptor. This is obviously... You're at the North Slope at probably what?
Latitude 70.
70 degrees.
Yeah.
So you're 30 degrees from the North Pole. High, high Arctic latitudes. Obviously, this is land that 70 million years ago was at either a lower latitude or it was warmer through a difference in climate.
Actually, from the research that my scientist buddies have been doing, that area of land was actually farther north at the time, and not farther south.
So the climate was definitively warmer or tropical or savanna or what?
See, it was warm. There were no ice caps on the planet then. It was forested because we found big chunks of petrified tree trunks up there.
So that's the coolest fossil you ever found. What is the coolest fossil that you've had in your hands or would like to see or touch or salivate over?
By far and away, the coolest fossil I ever beheld was one that transfixed me and ruled my life for a good 20-plus years. It was...
Let me guess.
You know it.
The Helicoprion, the buzzsaw shark whorl, the whorl.
That's right, right. I say Helicoprion, and...
Does anybody else say Helicoprion?
Most of the world, yeah.
Okay, so then...
But I'm claiming it back, man. I'm putting the hell back in Helicoprion.
I like that. Okay, the hell, because this was
right.
A... Mother of a shark. This was a sharp shark.
It was a very sharp
shark. This had a whorl of a round buzzsaw of teeth.
A buzzsaw of teeth, but the day that I saw it was 1993, not far from you. It was
in Los Angeles, L.A. County Museum.
The L.A. County Museum. I was touring the collection with my friend J.D. Stewart and my co-author on the book Planet Ocean, Brad Mattson. And we were down in the basement of the vertebrate collection, and JD just kind of gestures, hey, check this out. And it was sitting on the floor. It was sitting on the concrete floor. It looked like it was actually being used as a doorstop, and I'm not kidding you. It was just like, oh, there's this rock over here. I thought it was an ammonite when I first glanced at it, but it's a beautiful spiral. And he said, check it out. That is not an ammonite. Those are shark teeth. And I literally fell to my knees, just like, what? 20 years of my life went by.
this particular fossil, are the teeth obviously separated from the matrix of the rock? I mean, you can tell they are, like, not enamel because it's so old, but are they shiny and smooth like teeth with serrated edges?
Oh, yeah. This was a beautiful concretion that had come from Idaho. But JD told me that day, nobody's ever understood this spiral of teeth. Nobody's ever figured it out. There have been a lot of theories.
And if you look up Helicoprions, you can see all these weird different versions of how people thought they were. Some guy thought it was on the back of a shark.
Yeah, and I took this upon myself, and I didn't let it go. But that really is a whole other
story. Yeah, so you've been salivating over the Helicoprion, the buzzsaw shark, for how many years now?
Well, 1993. What's the math? I'm still obsessed with it.
But isn't it true that it was through your obsession that new light and papers were written pretty much describing how you thought the placement of this whorl of teeth truly existed through your...
I was a catalyst.
I was a catalyst.
I was a link. Because there were guys before me that had figured it out. Nobody listened to him. Nobody popularized it.
Right.
So I wasn't like I truly figured it out. But then
you built a metal row of teeth and you were cutting up chunks of ham or something for a demo.
Like I said, I went way deep.
Good. Good. But that makes you a paleo nerd, dude. It's where you actually lose yourself to your obsession. That's what a nerd is.
That is what a nerd is. You don't pay attention to reality. But I got to say, it's as beautiful as an ammonite. There's a certain beauty in that spiral, right? You know, that Fibonacci sequence, if you will. That beauty.
It's in a flower. It's in the way certain...
Yeah, it's in the galaxies. It's just... And this one particular fossil, and it's on display now. It's no longer on the concrete floor. Out in the rotunda as you walk into the L.A. County Museum. And, you know, I had a part in that. So now it's on display. It gets the respect that it truly deserves. But it was just a beautiful fossil.
That is awesome. And that is the one that you salivate over. What's the one you've never seen that you'd like to touch or investigate close up?
I'd have to give that a good think. And while I'm thinking of that, why don't we pose the question to you? What's the coolest fossil that you have fondled, beheld, and gazed upon?
I was fortunate enough to visit a bunch of back collections at museums through your introduction of Kirk Johnson when he was head of the Denver Museum.
The Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and he was one of the vice presidents there.
And so I visited a exhibit that you had there on the Amazon.
Yep.
And I was able to go through the collections. And I held in my hand a fully massive 6-7 inch long T-Rex tooth.
Aha.
And it was perfect. It was obviously a little brown in color. It wasn't, you know, glistening white with blood on it or anything. But it was so big and so huge, this was a Tyrannosaurus Rex tooth. Had sliced through and chomped on many, many other dinosaurs for its 40-year life.
Yeah, you know, you were holding the whole thing with the root on it.
Yeah, with the root.
So the tooth that I found, the Nanuxaurus, it was
just the tip, yeah.
It was broken off, but the Tyrannosaurs were able to grow, you know, more teeth. They would break them off all the time. And so it was breaking off. The one that I held had been broken off chewing on a Hadrosaur. But yeah, no, to hold a T-Rex tooth, the whole thing, they're massive. It's kind of mind-blowing.
But that brings me to the reason why this tooth meant so much to me was because I imagined the millions of sunsets flying by 70 million years to when this creature was alive. And that's what I love about being a paleo nerd is the imagination, trying to imagine these worlds, these ecosystems, the pathology of bone, that this was once a living creature. It lived, it died, it drank water. And that imagination is what drives me to love learning about paleo. Is it the same with you?
Oh, yeah, man. Why care about dinosaurs, man? Well, it's hard to explain. Kids are easily drawn to them. They're big and impressive. And you have to use your imagination to picture them. And I think that's...
But do you do that? Do you dream? Do you go back in time and do you think about a Thursday at 3 o'clock, 77.2 million years? Literally, there was a Thursday at 3 o'clock in the Cretaceous.
Right, when comets hit. And one of the things I have learned over the years, too, is that when you look out at the world today, you can't just imagine that there's dinosaurs running around in the wilderness that we see today, the world looked completely different. And trying to imagine what that world looked like, the Cretaceous was close to looking like what we have today in terms of forests at the end of the Cretaceous. But, you know, we have flowering plants and all that. But Southeast Alaska didn't look like Southeast Alaska. What's the world like without flowers? What's the world like without grass, you know?
Grass is recent. Right. Grass is just in the last 50 million years.
But I think it's paleontology has taken on a much more important meaning these days in that we humans now are realizing that maybe we've really changed the entire planet, and the planet is going through these drastic changes. We have climate change deniers who are saying, well, the Earth is always going through changes. Well, we know that's true. But if we look at the record, we can really see
How fast
and how rapidly you can get into the nuances of the argument. The planet usually does not have polar ice caps. We have been living in this sort of fluke of a time period in a way, you know, between
glaciations.
Well, between glaciations, but we're coming out of the ice world now rapidly into the warm world.
The hottest time the planet has ever seen was not long after the end of the Cretaceous.
Right.
The hottest time where temperatures were, 5-10 degrees hotter than they are now? I mean, it was literally an oven Earth.
Yeah, they call it the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum.
That's right. The P-E-T-M. Petum.
Petum.
Go ahead. Petum.
You just petum.
And that was, about 50 million years ago?
I think about 55.
55. And when is the rise of whales from a land creature to the ocean? About 50 million years ago, right?
They rapidly evolve in the Eocene. So I've been thinking, Dave, you asked me what is the coolest fossil I'd ever like to see, right?
Yeah.
And I've got it, man. There's a gigantic ammonite fossil in British Columbia. It's up in the mountains. I have talked about going there for years and years, friends. You know, I've tried to make a special trip there, but it's in the mountains above Fernie, British Columbia. It's quite a hike, but it is.
It's not the Burgess Shale,
no,
is it?
No, the Burgess Shale would be super cool too, but that's on the other side of the province. But Fernie has got some Cretaceous stuff way up in the mountains, and it is the biggest damn ammonite ever, man. It's like 6 feet across and maybe even a little bit bigger, but people hike up to it and it's gigantic and it's just huge. It's a magical spot.
So it's sitting in the, it's still in the rock then, unexcavated.
It's still in the rock and you cannot take it out, and it's been like, it's kind of a well-known secret now, but I guess they're actually taking people up to see it, but I would love to do it. It's quite a hike. It's a massive cephalopod stuck in the side of a mountain. Just gives you a real impression of how big those big octopus squid-like armored creatures were, man.
Well, do you think that the mosasaurs and pliosaurs evolved big size because that their prey evolved bigger, or they evolved together in size?
Yeah, it's a whole big thing happening in the neighborhood below the sea there. And, you know, one thing, a big thing begets another big thing.
Yeah, but weren't there ichthyosaurs that were like 60 feet long, a Shoshonosaurus?
Yeah, but that's in the Triassic.
Wrong again, Dave.
That's way before, and that actually was probably more like a filter feeder. Didn't have the big teeth. The pliosaurs had the big teeth, and the pliosaurs actually sort of disappear by the end of the Cretaceous. By then, it was really big mosasaurs, and some of the mosasaurs got 50 feet long. So they're goddamn big lizards, seagoing lizards.
That's like a swimming goanna. That's like a 50-foot swimming goanna.
Iguana, you mean? You're trying to say there? They're actually...
No, goanna.
What's a goanna?
G'day, mate. They're those huge lizards in Australia that are everywhere.
A goanna?
Yeah.
That's how they
say
it? You
don't know what a goanna is?
I've never heard of it. It's an Aussie thing.
Oh, goodness, dear. Dude, they're basically monitor lizards.
Well, the closest living relatives of the mosasaurs are the monitor lizards, and actually Komodo dragons. So Komodo dragons, the biggest lizard in the world.
Well, I was close then in comparing it to a goanna.
So that's my cool, that's a fossil I'd love to see. Hey, man, well, we've been talking with Shooting the Breeze here, but I want to know, Dave, if you could go back in time, if you could time travel, what time period would you go to and what would you want to see?
That's a good one. And I've given it lots of thought over the decades.
And I think I would like to go back to the Archean.
What?
Yeah. I would like to get down there with a microscope and see that very first cell that goes from inorganic to organic. I want to see a bunch of molecules form out of that primordial bubble and turn into a living cell. That's what I want to see. I want to see, did it come from a meteorite or space dust? Or was it a million years of soapy suds at the seashore? Where was it, a lightning bolt that hit the ocean and then caused that, you know, that famous experiment where they took a flask and they filled it with primordial gases and they subjected it to electricity? And I think they created amino acids. But I want to see that first day at 2 p.m. on a Monday
back in the Archean eon 4.6 billion years ago when life first appeared on planet Earth.
It probably appeared all over the planet pretty much simultaneously, I would think. Or maybe it didn't. Maybe it was just off the shore of New Jersey.
Well, that's pretty cool. You want to actually see the beginning of life on our planet.
Yes.
It sounds kind of dull, though, really. I mean, what about the dinosaurs and stuff, the big scary creatures? You want to see some little tiny things that you can't even see, really?
I have Jurassic Park if I want to see dinosaurs. I have Walking with Dinosaurs if I want to see more documentary type. I have your artwork, which is mind-blowing. I see all the dinosaurs. King Kong. The last King Kong with Jack Black and those three Tyrannosauruses fighting over each other was absolutely insane. Okay? So it's already there.
All right, point taken.
No, I want to see the origin of life on planet Earth.
And what if you could just sort of stub it out and nothing ever happened? We wouldn't be here. Oh, man, that's the hippie in me. All right.
So in other words, while I'm looking at it, I accidentally lean my elbow on the...
Yeah, yeah. And that's,
and
that's
I
it.
Stamp out all life on planet Earth. Well, then I guess you'd have to pray to me.
Or you could mix your DNA
okay,
in there
okay,
somehow.
Okay, wait, wait, wait. Hold on. Now you're going crazy. Okay, all right. I have a question to ask you now.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, of all the epochs and periods on planet Earth, where would you want to go back in time and why?
You keep saying epochs. I say epoch. We just keep going back. So what?
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. An epoch, E-P-O-C-H. Epic is E-P-I-C.
If you go and you check it out, people don't say epoch. It's epic. It's a good check with Wikipedia and the
okay.
little pronunciation
all right.
things.
All right. You're always correcting me, Ray.
I am, David. I'm trying to not be embarrassed when we get finally invited to that great cocktail party with all the paleontologists. And you're over there saying, epoch, epoch. Oh, it'd be so freaking embarrassing.
Okay.
All right. Anyways, where would I like to, when would I like to go back to? That's the question. I would like to travel back, because I'm a fish guy, 380 million years ago. And
Devonian.
I want to go to the late Devonian. There's great diversity in the oceans. The placoderms, the dunkleosteuses and all that stuff, and the sharks are diversified. And there's big armored fish, but there's also bony fish. And there's a ray fin fish, but then there's the all-important lobe-finned fish. And these are the fish that gave rise to the amphibians, and then the reptiles, and then the birds, and then the mammals, and then the primates, and to us. So there are no vertebrates walking around on land. And there is this fish, this very famous fish.
Like Tiktaalik.
Tiktaalik, but actually closer than Tiktaalik. It's been bumped out of the place, out of the, it's not the closest lake anymore. There's an animal.
John Long's paper?
Yes, with a number of Canadian scientists. And it's an animal called Elpistostege. And it's a Devonian lobe-finned fish.
Easy for you to say.
It is. Elpistostege. I even do it with a little flair. Elpistostege. Anyways, Elpistostege is an incredible transitional animal. Talk about your missing links. But here is a creature that's the fins actually have the beginnings of fingers. And this transition.
So you mean it has the digits and the.
Yes. And so actually fingers, you know, and it is literally. Oh. See, that's where the word comes from. But there was a day when that first fish, air-breathing fish, with one bone here, two bones there, you know, in the arms. But then it actually had fingers, And it's using that to prop itself up.
Just to recap, the body plan is one big bone in your upper arm,
yes.
Two bones in your middle arm, and then lots of little bones in your hand and fingers.
And we had in previous fish fossils in Tiktaalik, there were the other bones here sort of in the wrist area. But then El Pistostege actually has the fingers in place.
Oh, fingers,
the fingers
right.
are there. Fish had fingers and they crawled up on the land. And actually talk about, you know, if that day had never happened, if those creatures, if fish like El Pistostege, and we're pretty sure El Pistostege has got to be, if it's not the animal, it's something darn near. If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here, man. We wouldn't be talking. And that day that the fish crawled up onto the land and began that transition to amphibians, we wouldn't be here. None of us would be here. We should celebrate that day. You know, International Lobefin Fish Appreciation Day. Something like that.
I know why you want to be there.
Why?
Because you want to grab him by the gills and not have to spend all the money on fishing tackle.
Actually, you could do that. But, you know, what's cool is that, like, you would be the only creature walking. You wouldn't have to worry about something eating you because there's basically nothing in these vast lycopod forests other than scorpions.
The Eurypterids.
Well, they're in the water.
Both. Yeah, but they apparently were some of the first land creatures because they have trace track fossils of them.
I am proud of you, Sensei. Yes, I've taught you well. Yes, so there were Eurypterids up on land. There were also, yeah, scorpions, big millipedes, and giant dragonflies. They hadn't developed a taste for blood yet, so I don't know.
Well, I have a question. So when, what's his name? Stega something?
El Pistostege. Say it with me.
El Pistostege.
That's it. Good man.
El Pistostege. So when El Pistostege walked on land, that was in the late Devonian early, that was just before the Carboniferous?
Yes, that's right, late Devonian.
So then there were the huge swampy forests and petrified forest type.
That's right. Well, in the Devonian, there were big forests too, but they really take off.
So there was land plants and everything an environment.
Yeah, we see the first land plants in the Silurian, so, you know, millions of years before all this. So the world was, forested at that time in the Devonian. So, yeah, it'd be a cool time. And I would love to actually go to Quebec where El Pistostege was found. And that beautiful fossil is on display. And that's our grandma. You know, that's where we came from, dude.
It is.
So
it is literally our great, 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 great grandparent.
And I am not lying to you when I say scientifically that you are a wayward lobe-fin fish. You are descended from those fish. So
then that's not an insult.
No, it's a cool thing.
If you were to call me you dirty lobe-finned fish, it's really a fact.
Your mama was a lobe-fin fish.
I just love the idea that the fossil record is so complete and so incomplete at the same time.
Yeah, man. Dance into the fossil record. It's got a lot of skips in it, though, you know? Show us the missing links. And actually, over the last 30, 40 years, we've got so many missing links all filled in. It's pretty insane.
Well, you know, my dog at the river today was a transitional sea mammal.
Going back to the sea, was it?
He was trying, and he was swimming with his paws and his webbed feet, so.
That's how you get seals and sea lions.
Okay, so is there any recent discovery, and I'm almost going to point to Kirk Johnson's NOVA TV documentary called Polar Extremes, which shows the amazing habitats and ecosystems that existed at both poles that were obviously much warmer climates than exist today. So what is that going to teach us, and how are we going to move forward with this knowledge, and how can we change people's view that we need to do something about the petroleum industry and the burning of fossil fuels, and the internal combustion engine is really something that needs to be obsolete?
I think we have a real challenge ahead of us because it is a very nuanced argument when you start looking at the fossil record. You know, in some ways, I feel like, yeah, you know, the planet will rebound from the scourge that humanity is causing with the planet. But it's really whether or not we can survive it. Humans can survive it. The planet will do okay.
We will survive. Miami, they'll just have to move to higher ground. And what is the highest hill in Florida? 30 feet? I mean, they're going to have to basically move away. You can't keep building seawalls as the ocean rises.
Right.
There's a point to where a seawall just won't work.
The current pandemic that you and I and the rest of the planet are all riding out right now, I think, should,
Well, there's a pandemic?
Yes, there is.
No way.
Yeah, way. That, if anything, is taught is how connected and how fragile and interconnected the world is, you know? And just like that, a virus brings humanity to a screeching halt.
Yeah.
It's a tough road we got ahead of us, man. But I think that knowledge is power. And I think things like goofy paleo podcasts. And I think the only way really to change the world is the power of 10-year-olds and the next generation and the power of education. And I think that paleo is a real gateway into that because it's just fascinating, you know?
And it's fun.
And that's why, you know, as a kid, I was fascinated with dinosaurs because they were real. They weren't dragons. They weren't trolls. They weren't ogres. They weren't mythical things. They were real. And I soon found out that dinosaurs are one thing and that there were prehistoric mammals. And before them, there were all these little things like trilobites and ammonites. And so it's been a lifelong adventure. And I think paleo is a beautiful way to see the world, man, because you see it in its entirety. You understand how we came to be here and how all these different animals came to be here and our part in the animal world. You know, I was brought up as a Catholic. And
I'm sorry.
I know you were brought up in a weird religion I don't know what you were brought up as, Dave.
The true religion. I was brought up in the true religion of nothing. Nothingness.
Right. That's pretty heavy stuff. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I was brought up thinking that we were separate from the animal world.
And we are not. Why is science important?
I think science is important because science is based on facts, observable, testable facts, facts that are not squishy. You can't have alternative facts, but you can always, you know, seek to find the truth. And that's because maybe one thing that we found out, you know, once upon a time, we find out more things. So it's ever evolving. You got to keep track of it. We know a lot more now than we did in 1850, right?
Right.
So by testing and testing and testing and peer-reviewed papers and scientific symposiums, we challenge each other, but we arrive at facts.
I think we can also say that we can prepare our future by learning from the past.
Yes. I think the only way to know where we're going is to know where we've been, right?
Awesome.
To know about the past. Through paleo podcasts, through t-shirts, through whatever we can, through puppet shows, we can educate the people and have intelligent discussions.
You want to do it again? I learned so much about you. I had no idea.
Yeah, maybe you learned way too much. And there's some things about you I know now, too. So, yeah.
Puppets.
Puppets, the being raised with no religion and all that nothingness. Anyways, it was cool. I really enjoyed it, man. So let's...
Well, we should do this again. I think we should. I mean, you have a bevy of scientists in your Rolodex, don't you?
I do. I got them right over here in the old Rolodex. We could call them up if you want to do it.
Who could we talk to? Who do you know
Well, we mentioned the guy a couple times already. How about Kirk Johnson?
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Oh, he's a heavy hitter, man. He is, what, director of the Smithsonian, right?
Yes, the director of the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. And
let's do it. I would love to talk to him. You know what? Why don't we have him be our first episode? Well, really, our second episode.
Yeah. The first one's all about us. I like that, you know. But then let's let's turn to Kirk. And let's see. He's a bona fide scientist. I think he's really one of the planet's greatest minds, and he's a cool guy, and you've met him before, but let's pick his brain.
Done deal.
All right,
well, this is Dave signing off from Ojai, California.
Raymond Troll signing off from beautiful Ketchikan, Alaska.
Thank you for listening to Paleo Nerds. Make sure to like and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you're listening. If you want to learn more about what you heard today, check out our website, paleonerds.com. You'll find tons of pictures and links, including photographic evidence that today's guest and your hosts have been paleo nerds for a long, long time. Again, that's paleonerds.com. Thanks for listening.